Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Jamal Khashoggi was a columnist for The Washington Post. A U.S. resident, he came to the United States to be able to continue writing amid a crackdown on dissent in his native Saudi Arabia. But on October 2nd, he entered the Saudi consulate in Turkey and never came out. The next day, Saudi authorities issued a statement confirming his disappearance, but insisting he had left their consulate. The story would change several times in the ensuing days. Mid-month, Saudi authorities confirmed Khashoggi died during a fight inside the consulate and announced the arrest of 18 Saudi nationals. It was the first time the kingdom admitted Khashoggi had died, but on October 17th, the New York Times reported comments from a Turkish official who said that upon entering the consulate, Khashoggi was dead within minutes, beheaded, dismembered, his fingers severed, and within 2 hours, the killers were gone. The president of Turkey says the journalist was the victim of a carefully planned political murder by Saudi intelligence officers and other officials. President Trump responded they had a very bad original concept. It was carried out poorly, and the cover-up was the worst in the history of cover-ups. Well, clearly, we still have much to learn about what exactly happened and why and just how involved the Saudi crown prince was in the plan to murder Jamal Khashoggi. But the incident has raised many questions about the implications of his death, our own ties to Saudi Arabia, and the complex political motives driving all of this. So this hour, we've invited some people who can shed some light on all of it. And we start with Karim Fahim, Istanbul bureau chief for The Washington Post, who joins us via Skype. Thank you for joining.
Thanks for having me.
And in fact, you are in Istanbul this morning, and you have to leave shortly, so I'll make best use of your time here. Mr. Khashoggi, as I said, was a resident of the United States. He came here to be able to continue writing critically about his home country. He was supposed to be married the day after his murder and went to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, I understand, to take care of the details of a previous divorce. Why did he have to do that there? Why couldn't that be accomplished here in the United States?
Well, we were told by Turkish officials that the Turkish government required him to receive the document confirming his divorce from the consulate or from a Saudi mission in Turkey specifically. So there had been rumors that maybe part of, you know, this larger Saudi plot to lure him back involved telling him that he needed to obtain his document in Turkey, but we don't at this point think it's true. We think it was just a Turkish bureaucratic matter.
Is that because, would that be because his wife, his fiancée, was from Turkey?
Yes, she's a Turkish citizen, that's right.
And in order to conclude the paperwork he had to conclude in the Saudi consulate, would he have had to make an appointment? In other words, they knew he was coming?
Yeah, so the timeline begins the Friday before the Tuesday he disappeared, when he entered the consulate in Istanbul and was told to return the following week. Now, I don't know whether, I don't think we know at all whether that was because they needed time to prepare the paperwork or that they decided that that's how the plan would proceed. But in either case, he was told to come back the following week, and President Erdogan said during a speech this week that that's when this Saudi plan was set into motion, that after Jamal's visit to the consulate, people from the consulate notified their counterparts back in Saudi Arabia.
Early accounts of this noted that Khashoggi was allegedly fearful about his safety and had used his Apple Watch to record what happened inside. If he was genuinely concerned about his safety, why did he go in alone?
That's a great question. We don't know the role of the Apple Watch. At some point during the investigation, there were reports that investigators were focusing on it, but we don't necessarily think that's true anymore. But the larger question of whether of why he entered while he feared for his safety as an exile is a very good one. And part of the answer is that he had visited the Saudi embassy in Washington several times without incident. And in fact, during one of the visits, reportedly had a long conversation with the ambassador there, who is the brother of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. He had received numerous phone calls over the last year from senior figures in the Saudi leadership, assuring him that he had the trust of the Crown Prince and trying to convince him to come back to Saudi Arabia. So that may have explained some of it.
We've heard about these recordings that were first we were told they were made by his Apple Watch and sent to the cloud, and some now believe that perhaps the Turkish government had bugged the consulate, and that's where the recordings came from, and they're loath to reveal that because that would be in violation of the Vienna Convention. But evidently, the CIA director, Gina Haspel, allegedly has heard these recordings. Has anybody else heard these recordings that we would trust?
There have been reports that the Turks have briefed a number of their allies on the contents of these audio recordings. We don't know how many people have actually heard them, but we reported today that she had, and we assume that she'll be briefing President Trump at some point about their contents. But, you know, as you say, the Turks have kept information about these recordings and their very existence purposefully vague, possibly to hide their surveillance methods.
So he left the kingdom. Khashoggi had left the kingdom to be able to continue writing pieces critical to the regime over there. What made him so dangerous to Saudi Arabia that either the ruling family or those who support the regime would feel the need to silence him by murdering him? I read a lot of his pieces in the Washington Post. Yeah, they were critical, but if I were the Crown Prince, I could live with what he said.
It's a great question. I think, you know, I think part of the answer is that he wasn't a dissident, or at least not a dissident in the sense of the word as we understand it. He was a former insider in the royal circles. He was somebody who was very close to the leadership for a very long time. And they may have people have speculated that they may have considered him more of a defector than a dissident. And that you know, if he was just a longtime dissident, he would have been easier to dismiss. But again, you know, we're still trying to figure out who ordered this and how it transpired. So it's not even clear that he was, you know, that this happened because he was considered extremely dangerous.
This may be a difficult question for you to answer because you were a colleague of Mr. Khashoggi and you know the Middle East well. But how would you describe his criticisms in writing in the Washington Post of that regime?
I think, as you said, they were. I think what stands out about the things he wrote over the last year was that they challenged the sort of narrative that had taken hold, you know, in the United States and other parts of the West about what was transpiring in the kingdom under Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. You know, the sort of dominant narrative was about a young man, you know, forcefully shaking up the country, introducing very difficult reforms against all odds. And he was calling attention to this other sort of less narrative that was not being paid very close attention to, which was this, you know, extraordinary consolidation of power at the same time by the Crown Prince, a crackdown on, you know, dissenters, women's rights advocates, powerful clerics, rivals, prominent business people. And so some of that was surfacing in his columns, albeit, you know, often in friendly language and language that suggested, you know, that he wasn't opposed to the sort of grand project, but he was opposed to some of the tactics that were being used to accomplish Mohammed bin Salman's goals.
So he disappeared on October the 2nd, and I understand the Turkish government launched their investigation into what happened in the consulate on or about October the 15th. They searched the consulate for 9 hours. CNN reported that they discovered it had been recently repainted everywhere, which is unusual. The same day, President Trump, after having spoken to Saudi leaders, told reporters that rogue killers, that's a quote, could have been responsible. And the day before, you wrote an article in which you quote a Turkey analyst at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy as saying Turkey and Saudi Arabia were, quote, probably working toward a graceful exit where they blame rogue elements of the Saudi state and throw one big significant name under the bus. Were the 18 Saudi nationals that the kingdom ultimately arrested rogue killers?
Well, nobody who knows how Saudi Arabia works believes that it's possible that a carefully planned operation involving lots of Saudi agents could go forward without the approval of somebody in the leadership. So we don't know yet, but it seems unlikely.
Do we know if
I should just add that today the Saudis are saying that it was in fact a pre-planned operation. They're saying that that announcement is based on information that they've received from the Turkish authorities, but it's a significant change to their previous assertion that there was a fist fight in the embassy.
Yeah. Yes, and the Crown Prince has said that the entire country is shocked and sad. I'm paraphrasing here, shocked and saddened by this incident. But do we know if some of these 18 Saudi nationals who have been arrested for this are the same people caught on video that the Turkish government suggests shows a team of Saudi agents dispatched to Istanbul to commit this crime?
The Saudi government hasn't released the names of the 18 people, but we've been told by Saudi officials that 15 of those people are the 15 that the Turks had previously talked about, the teams that were dispatched to Istanbul beginning on October 1st and then on October 2nd.
Are they likely to be punished, or are they simply going to disappear from our public view?
It's a great question. We don't know what's going to happen to them, and we don't know whether there will be further action taken against other more senior officials who the Saudis said were dismissed from their posts after their preliminary investigation. And those people include two senior advisors to the Crown Prince.
Have about a minute left here. There's a rivalry between Turkey and Saudi Arabia, and of course, the press in Turkey isn't exactly free. Their aggression in trying to get to the bottom of this, is this politically based, or is it simply because they're as shocked by this crime as everybody else?
I mean, I think a lot of Turks are shocked by this. I think they're offended by the fact that the Saudis did this here. But that being said, I think the Turkish president has a lot of different motivations for pushing this case so hard, for pushing for a resolution to this case, and prolonging the sort of investigation. He does see Mohammed bin Salman as a rival. He's in the Middle East. Maybe hoping to win concessions from the United States as well as the Saudis.
Karim Fahim is the Istanbul bureau chief for the Washington Post. Thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate
Thanks.
It.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, we'll be joined by two local professors who also know the situation pretty well. We're coming back in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, a Washington Post reporter in the Saudi Arabian consulate in Turkey, in Istanbul, on October the 2nd. And to continue our discussion, we welcome Mohammed El Nawawi, professor of International Communication and Middle Eastern Studies at Queen's University of Charlotte. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
He is obviously in our Spirit Square studio, along with Catherine Johnson, professor of religious studies, specializing in Middle Eastern politics at UNC. Sharm, thank you for joining us.
Well, good morning, and thank you for inviting me.
Welcome back. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can do so. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for us on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at charlottetalks. And you can also watch my two guests here on Facebook Live. So the politics of that region is immensely complicated. In that same speech, well, I didn't reference the speech. I didn't have time. The Turkish president, Erdogan, made a speech recently in which he said he provided intriguing new details, but in which the reporter we just talked to said he provided intriguing new details, but failed to deliver the, quote, naked truth, unquote, that he had promised. And that had generated global interest. In that same speech, he never mentioned the crown prince. He called instead on his father, King Salman, for justice. Does Erdogan see Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as a rival, or simply was he being respectful to the father, the king?
I think he's being a bit cautious right now because Turkey has the advantage on the court. He obviously has a number of details that would be quite embarrassing were they revealed, but he's holding his hand and selectively revealing information and letting the public make assumptions about who's behind it. Because the more information that comes out, the guiltier Prince Mohammed bin Salman and his father, the king, look.
But is this the pot calling the kettle black? I mean, Erdogan is not exactly a saint.
Well, that is the case. But right now, he has the upper hand because he has the details and an enormous possibility of ways to embarrass the Saudis.
Okay. H.A. Hellyer, a senior non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council think tank, says he's hoping that by going about this in sort of a delicate fashion, that the king himself will decide that Mohammed bin Salman ought not to be a crown or the crown prince. Is that a possibility, Dr. Al-Nawawi?
I think I agree with Catherine that the more that the Turkish investigate into this, the more tight that the circle is going to be around the crown prince and his father. I like that the Turkish media have really been dripping information, bits and pieces of information to the international media. And they did that at the right time. Whenever the Saudis would release information that didn't make sense, the Turkish officials would come forth with some strategically leaked information.
Why are they doing it that way? Why don't they just give us a data dump and be done with it? Why are they trickling it out?
Because they still want to leave the door open for the Saudis. We have to remember that Turkey and Saudi Arabia are very strong strategic allies. And there are many cards that President Erdogan has in his hands, and he wants to use these cards at the right time. So he doesn't want to just let go of everything that he has at this point to continue to play that game with the Saudis.
So if they are strategic allies, did the Crown Prince believe, perhaps, if he in fact is involved in this, and let's give him the benefit of the doubt, did he or others believe perhaps that they would turn a blind eye to this in Turkey because they are strategic allies?
I think Turkey and Saudi Arabia could very nicely be described using a term young people use. That's frenemies. They have a lot of common interests, but they are also rivals in the regional power game.
Mm-hmm. What is the crux of the friction between the two countries?
Well, two things. One, an ideological disagreement, which really dates back to the Arab Spring. Turkey has its own vision of how the region should be transformed, and Saudi Arabia has its vision. So they are competing there. The other thing is they have some conflicts over policy in Syria.
So, and Qatar, right?
Oh, yes. We have to bring up the situation with Qatar.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, we in standard, we would say Qatar, uh-huh. But they pronounce it Qatar.
Okay.
Now, why are they and their UAE allies trying to isolate Qatar? Well, they like to say it's because the government there is too sympathetic to Iran. But the fact of the matter is they are really angry at Al Jazeera because Al Jazeera often brings out very uncomplimentary things about the Saudis and the UAE. So I think they would like to bully them into turning down the volume there.
Turkey also supports movements, I'm told, like the Muslim Brotherhood. And Dr. El Nawawi, you've just written and released a book called Revolutionary Egypt in the Eyes of the Muslim Brotherhood. So you know something about this organization. Why do they support them, and why is the Saudi regime opposed to them?
So to provide more context to what Catherine has alluded to, the crisis in the Persian Gulf has started back in June 2017 when Saudi Arabia and three other Arab countries have imposed an embargo on the country of Qatar. Mm-hmm. And Turkey sided with Qatar. In fact, they salvaged the situation because products coming from Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates were stopped overnight, literally. And Turkey stepped in and they flooded the Qatari market with their own products. In addition to having some, you know, companies operate in Qatar, so in addition to that, Turkey has hosted many of the political dissidents who belong to the Muslim Brotherhood, who fled from countries like Egypt and Saudi Arabia in the course of the Arab Spring back in 2011, because Turkey wanted to come across as a country that supports the voiceless and stands with the marginalized in the region. And for that reason, the friction has started between Turkey and Saudi Arabia. And now there are talks even that there may be a deal that may be struck behind closed doors between the Turks and the Saudis by having the Saudis lift the embargo on Qatar, and for the, in return that the Turks would come kind of, you know, come easy on focusing too much on implicating the crown prince.
This is ancient history in my very fuzzy memory here, but the Muslim Brotherhood is no friend to Egypt, or they don't. Egypt doesn't view them.
But the current government,
does not view them as friends. So why? What is it about the Muslim Brotherhood that Turkey finds appealing, that Saudi Arabia finds threatening?
We have to remember the roots of the current government in Turkey is based on the Muslim Brotherhood. This is an Islamist government based on the ruling party, which is Freedom and the Justice and Development Party, AK in Turkish. Mm-hmm. So President Erdogan finds some natural strategic alliance with the Muslim Brotherhood, and it was to his interest that the Muslim Brotherhood experience would continue to be successful in Egypt, but this didn't happen, obviously, and the Muslim Brotherhood only stayed in power in Egypt for 1 year, and they were ousted.
And the Turks actually at the time were very supportive of this government in Egypt that was actually a Muslim Brotherhood government. In contrast, the Saudis are terrified of the possibility that the ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood would be appealing to their own people. So they do have an ideological conflict with the Turks.
So this pas de deux that the Turks are doing with Saudi Arabia reminds me of the dance number in West Side Story between the Sharks and the Jets. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very choreographed and threatening, but it's a game of chicken, essentially. So what options are open to Turkey if they want to make an issue of this murder on their soil when, in fact, it occurred in the consulate, which is not their soil? What are their options?
They are actually pursuing their best option right now, because by this slow-motion humiliation of Prince Mohammed and his father, they are accomplishing a lot, because Prince Mohammed has been sold as the talented young reformer who's going to take the kingdom forward. He's the master planner behind Vision 2030, which is the big Saudi reform agenda. Mm-hmm. Now, foreign investors, and I'll tell you, I did some numbers on this. In order for this plan to succeed, they're going to need $4 trillion in foreign investment. They're going to have to create 6 million jobs. And right now, half of the Saudi GDP comes from petroleum. They have an enormous task in front of them. And one of the best ways to intimidate Prince Mohammed is to make him look as though he is the hot-headed, untrustworthy heir apparent. Why would you want to put money in the kingdom? You see this Davos in the desert is collapsed.
Is that because if money goes to Saudi Arabia, it's not going to Turkey?
Oh, no. If you ruin the public image of the prince who is the leader behind this, you can definitely weaken Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
And now the king is going to be put in a situation. We come to the question they're debating in Washington. Are we going to continue to back this questionable heir apparent, or are we going to push for change? In fact, there's even been mention that King Salman may put forward one of his other sons as a potential partner along with Prince Mohammed.
Go ahead.
I may add to that the Turks have their own share of economic struggles that they have been going through right now. I mean, the Turkish lira has really been devalued over the past few months. And so the Turks need the money from the Gulf. They need the money from the Saudis. And the Saudis have been kind of trying to funnel in, hundreds of millions of dollars into the Turkish economy. So the question here is, will the Turks succumb to this kind of alluring by the Saudis at this critical juncture in their economy, or will they stand to their ground and to hold on to the facts of the investigation and implicate the Crown Prince to be the case?
So this 2030 plan, is that being put into place, or are they trying to work toward that? Obviously, it's in place because of the diminishing need on the part of the United States for Saudi oil, or is there something else at play?
Well, they have look to the future and identify three real problems. Long term, they can't count on perpetually high oil prices. In fact, that's going to be rather unpredictable. They have up to 30 to 40% foreign workers in the kingdom, and they have a number of young people who are unemployed and not necessarily academically well prepared to find a job. Mm-hmm. So the plan, which they call Vision 2030, is supposed to remedy those anticipated problems with oil pricing and switch the kingdom's focus on a private economy as opposed to one based on oil sales.
And that's the job of the Crown Prince, to make sure that that happens. Is that why this younger man was appointed by his still-living father, the king, to essentially run the country? Is that why? Because he could do it because he was younger, or because he has a vision that the king doesn't have? Why did the king make his son essentially the ruler?
There are many stories told about that. One is that he was appointed initially with his cousin. The other is that he is a very ambitious man. Mm-hmm. And the third might be that the official line of the Saudi government is that he is brilliant and talented and the absolute perfect choice to lead the country forward.
Where's the truth?
Well, he has control over his father, who is getting very old, in his late 70s, early 80s. So there are talks that, Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS, as he's known in the Western media, is really having a big, big impact, a huge impact on his father.
So the king handed the power to his son. When that happened, the West hailed this as a sign of imminent reform. A lot of major TV networks in this country, including CBS's 60 Minutes, did big profiles on the Crown Prince.
Yes.
They painted him as a guy loosening up Saudi society, allowing women to drive, allowing women to start a business, allowing women to join the military, to attend concerts and sporting events, which they had not been allowed to do prior to that. He has said that women are equal to men. He has reopened movie theaters. They hadn't had any movie theaters there forever. And yet there is, some say, this dark side to the Crown Prince, aside from possibly sanctioning or ordering Khashoggi's murder. In November of 2017, four ministers, 11 princes, and several high-profile entrepreneurs were detained on orders of the Crown Prince in what was presented as an anti-corruption purge. However, the measures targeted many of his direct rivals, and some believe that's emblematic of his ambition and his attempt to consolidate power. How do you see it?
Well, here's the thing. He has spent millions marketing his image as the, you know, the talented reformer, the reformer of Islam, the liberalizer of Saudi society. He has made some careful gestures, for example, letting women drive. But the fact of the matter is the guardian system is still in place. A woman has to have a wali, a guardian, to get married, to get an education, to travel. That's what really restrains women. But the gesture of driving was very popular in the West. On the other hand, he has at least 1,500 intellectuals, religious scholars, and critics imprisoned. Last year, he had the famous event at the Ritz-Carlton where he incarcerated almost 400 people for 3 months and walked away with, what, $107 billion in payments and confessions. So there's this other side of him. He is very intolerant of criticism. He is manipulative. So the image that he has in the West is not necessarily what you see as his performance.
Many of these reforms that you alluded to are very superficial because, take for example, the women. He allowed women to drive, but then he imprisoned the women activists who have called for more reform for the society in general. He led Saudi Arabia into a very catastrophic war in Yemen that has been going on for more than 3 years now, and the United States has supported that war by selling weapons to Saudi Arabia, and this is really one of the biggest issues that we have to look into. He also held hostage the Lebanese prime minister in Riyadh for a few days last year. Mm-hmm. So this really points to a very serious side of the crown prince.
I have about 50 seconds left, but any of his repressions, the ones that that you've alluded to, based on his need for power and his need for suppressing criticism, or are they religiously based?
No, they are based purely on his need for more power and his wanting to make sure that there is no space where people can express any point of view that is opposite to his point of view.
Which leads us to some questions about media, which we'll get to when we come back after the break. Mohammed El-Nawawi is with us, professor of international communication and Middle Eastern studies at Queen's University of Charlotte, and Catherine Johnson, professor of religious studies also at UNC Charlotte. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Catherine Johnson is with us from UNC Charlotte. Mohammed El-Nawawi is with us from Queen's University of Charlotte. And we're getting a little cultural and geography and history lesson about Saudi Arabia and the Crown Prince there in light of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi by the, one presumes, elements within Saudi society, within their consulate in Turkey. Who exactly did it, under whose orders, is still to be determined. One observer of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia at the Chatham House think tank in London says that while government PR has been successful in touting social reforms like allowing women to drive, thereby improving the international reputation of the country, it's also allowed them to forego promising any kind of reforms where politics or human rights are concerned. It's a lipstick on a pig, essentially. Do you agree with that, either of you?
Well, if you, I'll let you know the listeners make judgment here. If you look at our policy in the region, I mean, traditionally American policy in the Middle East is based on 5 points: one, assuring continuous supply of oil and gas, and the Saudis are important players in that. They have 22% of the oil reserves in the world. They are a swing producer. Second point, we have as a policy goal preventing the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. The Saudis theoretically are important players in that, as well as in our objective of preventing areas which are ungoverned and where terrorism could potentially flourish. They are an important partner in our campaign against terrorism, as well as in our campaign to block Iran's efforts to expand its regional influence. And finally, in Syria, they are partners in our policy goal of trying to train up regional military so that they can defend their own countries. So in theory, Saudi Arabia is critical to our Middle East policy. But now the question is long term, are they going to be able to participate in meeting these goals if the next ruler is going to provide instability in the kingdom?
But if they are, in fact, in some way guilty of the murder of Khashoggi, they are also a country that permits crucifixion and beheading. They're a country that carries out legally sanctioned corporal punishment, including caning and flogging and body mutilation. Mm-hmm. The Crown Prince has, as we've said, consistently tried to silence those who are human rights activists. He's even tried to keep detentions secret, etc. What should our reaction to that be?
Well, we have to also remember that Saudis have really been funneling in hundreds of billions of dollars into the U.S. market through hiring PR firms to embellish their image and to try to cover up for some of the human rights violations. And that had led many congressmen to maybe turn a blind eye on what's happening inside
because
the kingdom.
Because they didn't know the truth? Because the PR was so successful? Or because they didn't really...
Our strategic interests are such
that they don't want to know the truth.
I'm afraid that some of them know what's happening inside the kingdom, and they are turning deciding to turn a blind eye.
Saudi Arabia consistently ranks low on press freedom. It ranks 169th out of 180 countries in the 2018 World Press Freedom Index. What does that mean for journalism?
In fact, that was one of the main reasons that Jamal Khashoggi was very vocal about the need for reform in Saudi Arabia. Okay. That he, in fact, in his last column before his killing, he wrote about the freedom of expression and the need for increasing the marginal freedom in the Arab world by looking into Freedom House reports that, as you said, Saudi Arabia has been consistently receiving very low marks when it comes to freedom of expression. And this does not go well with what we have been hearing about in terms of these quote-unquote superficial reforms that the Crown Prince has been calling for.
I could be wrong about this, but I do recall one report about the Khashoggi incident that said that the Crown Prince had warned media outlets in his country to be very careful about what they said about this incident because there would be repercussions. Language from journalists deemed critical of the government can, in fact, lead to detention under the country's counterterrorism laws, and journalists there are threatened with public punishment, even death.
In fact, I've been closely monitoring the Saudi media coverage of the Khashoggi's killing, and it has been appalling, to say the least.
How have they been covering it?
Well, for the first maybe 4 or 5 days, they have totally ignored the issue, as if it hadn't happened. Mm-hmm. And then they, you know, after seeing that everybody else is covering it 24/7, then they started looking into it. And you could tell that they didn't want to. They were very reluctant to even cover it, but they had to because they wanted to defend the government's line. And they wanted to make sure that they present or project the government point of view, which was very contradictory. And so that was reflected also in the coverage.
What's the impact of that on the people of Saudi Arabia? In other words, do they have access to international media? Can they see CNN?
Yes.
Can they see
the majority of the Saudis?
Al Jazeera.
The majority of the Saudis are very young, in their 20s and 30s, and I have no doubt that they're going, into social media and seeing what's going on. But they cannot
control
open
the internet. Does he control social media?
But there are ways around. Yeah. There are ways around that. You know, we can use proxies and get around it.
In fact, you're increasingly seeing this. We're taking a look at change of public sentiment. The opposition to Prince Mohammed is getting increasingly better organized, mm-hmm. More analytical of government policies. For example, you have the government supporters support stability and continuity with father and son. And then you have a growing generation of young intellectuals, educated Saudis, who are saying, look at what this man is doing. We have no freedom of speech. We are not safe now from arrest. Religious scholars criticize the changes, not because they're conservative, but because they see incredible violations of the citizens' rights. And you have young people who are posting images of what's going on in Yemen, 13 million people are in risk of starvation. And they will post the news and they will comment, look what Prince Mohammed has led us into. We're spending millions of dollars on this and we are killing innocent Muslims.
But we have to think about the fact that the people inside the kingdom cannot be vocal about this. And especially with this killing of the of Jamal Khashoggi, I mean, think about the grave consequences that this would have not only on people inside the kingdom, but on dissidents outside the kingdom, that those people can think of now that nobody can help them if they are in trouble. You know, they can get after, they can go after them at any point in time. Lives are in danger.
New technology enables them to put the information out there.
So let's talk about
remain
why.
Anonymous.
Then why bother? Why bother to control your media if people can get access to the truth through other sources? This is like the communists during the Cold War, and the BBC and the Voice of America would somehow get through to people behind the Iron Curtain. This is even more. This is on steroids. Because people are using the internet and social media to get through. So why open up the society in one way, but still try to repress a media that can't be repressed?
It's a contradiction. And in fact, one of the reasons when people speculate why Khashoggi got killed, if you take a look at him, he was a gadfly. He was not a major, critic of the government. But he was representative of that generation now that is taking advantage of the technology, networking with one another, and getting word out. So in that way, it's a message. If you kill him in an incredibly brutal way and it becomes known to the other possible critics, they're going to be doubly careful before they speak out.
President Trump has been, let's put it this way, he's been more cautious than previous presidents might have been had this happened on their watch. He's been slow to condemn what's happened. He finally came to that. What is the importance to the United States of our relationship with Saudi Arabia?
Well, we have to remember that the president has been to Saudi Arabia more than a year ago, and he signed huge arms deals with them. Mm-hmm. So he's always bringing that.
But those deals have not been executed in the 2 years they have?
No, they have not.
They have not been executed since the time those deals were signed. So what's the big deal? Not to make a pun out of that, but what? Why? Why is that still important?
I guess from his perspective that he wants to keep that door open in terms of having the possibility that the Saudis are going to funnel in this money into the U.S. economy. Because adding to that, that his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has very strong bond with the Crown Prince. And
They're on WhatsApp together.
Yes, they are very close.
Are you serious? How do we know? Because the president has said many times that these people like Kim Jong-un like him. They get along splendidly. He likes Vladimir Putin. They get along splendid. He likes the Crown Prince. Is the feeling mutual, or is he being used? Because he likes being liked.
Well, you know, I can't delve into Mr. Trump's psychological situation. What I will say is there's going to be a lot of financial pressure to keep this relationship going, because Saudi Arabia, by amount, is the largest weapons purchaser in the world. India buys more quantity, but they buy quality.
And where are they going with that? What are they doing with the weapons we're selling?
There's a moral question.
They have the war in Yemen.
They are using it on Yemeni civilians. Now, we have to consider long-term America's status in the world community. Does it benefit us to have this relationship with Saudi Arabia, which may be unstable in the future, we don't know that, which is using our weapons systems to carry out a brutal war in Yemen? How much long-term benefit is that to the United States? We can talk about, you know, possible $110 billion in sales, but long-term, is this going to help us?
So the president has ultimately said that Saudi Arabia will be severely punished if it is proven that they had a hand in this murder. Should backing out of these arms deals be part of that punishment? Would they be part of that punishment? Who would suffer more if we did back out? Us, because we'd lose the money, or them, because they wouldn't get the arms?
I mean, that would be a good first step for sure. And I think that's the way that at least the majority of the Congress members who came out, who actually expressed their concerns about Khashoggi's death, said that they would do. Sometimes it takes one man's tragedy, because what has been happening in Yemen is the death of thousands of people every day. But this were just statistics for the American public. Right now, with Khashoggi's killing, it's a one man's tragedy. And I hope that this would serve as a tipping point for changing course with regard to the U.S.-Saudi relations, by putting more pressure on the Saudis to really implement real reforms, not superficial reforms.
Because the Washington Post argues that they need us more than we need them, that we are now energy independent in the United States, and in fact, we are now the largest exporter of oil, not Saudi Arabia. Further, they say, the Saudis have not signed a single arms deal with us, or completed a single arms deal with us, since Trump took office, and any end to supplies of U.S. spare parts would effectively ground their air force. And finally, they assert that Saudi Arabia would not survive without U.S. security support. I would think we wouldn't want necessarily to destabilize another country in the Middle East. So is it in our best interest to prop them up in some way, to prop the bin Salman regime up in some way?
Well, here's the point. I think they will be hurt much more than the United States. Mr. Trump has made comments that they can choose to buy their weapons elsewhere.
Can they?
That's not true with advanced weapon systems. It's not as though if I don't like the T-shirt you're offering, I'll go somewhere else and buy another T-shirt. You shop within a particular country's weapon systems. You stockpile spare parts. You train your crews to handle these particular weapon systems. You can't do a short turnaround on this, and they are very dependent on U.S. weapon systems.
If I may add, we should not expect the United States to introduce democratic reforms in Saudi Arabia or any other country for that matter. I think based on our experience with the Arab Spring, if there are going to be any democratic reforms, they have to come from the grassroots of these societies. They cannot be imposed by a superpower on any of these countries.
And is that possible, given the repression in that country and the threat of arrest and murder, etc.? Is it possible for the grassroots to take place?
I would like to think that it is possible, given that what we have seen in a country like Egypt, given what we have seen in countries like, even Yemen at the beginning before it slipped into that civil war.
The Crown Prince is a citizen of the world. He's very concerned about his image in the world. He's been very successful in painting a progressive image of himself and what he's doing in the country to the world. Why is he so afraid of criticism and of the press?
Well, if you look into the mind of someone who has so much power like that, I think psychologically they want to make sure that they are secure, because there's always a feeling of insecurity, and that haunts them, and that makes them really push them toward more repressive steps against their own people and against their own media.
I mean, does this this opaqueness give credence to Khashoggi's accusation of corruption at the highest levels of the Saudi government and within the royal family itself, which he has written about, where he said that they're in the business of enriching themselves? Does it give credence to that, this repression and this killing of Khashoggi himself?
Well, the repression and the sensitivity to criticism is something that did not just start with Prince Mohammed. It's been there. But the fact is, it may correct itself to a certain extent, because he's made a lot of enemies.
Catherine Johnson is professor of UNC, she's professor of religious studies, specializing in Middle Eastern politics at UNC Charlotte. Mohammed El Nawawi, professor of international communications and Middle Eastern studies at Queen's University of Charlotte, author of Revolutionary Egypt in the Eyes of the Muslim Brotherhood, and earlier Karim Fahim, Istanbul bureau chief for The Washington Post. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.